Hello and welcome to another edition of Webinar Extra.
This is where we bring you some more time with one of our webinar presenters so that we can answer some of those additional questions that, well, there just wasn't enough time for during the live event.
Think of it as the dessert to the main course.
You mean the bonus track at the end of the album?
I mean the podcast after the night before.
And if you haven't already seen the webinar, then you can head to our college online learning page and check it out.
Or you can just keep listening, nodding sagely while you wonder what everyone is banging on about. The choice is yours.
We hope you enjoy the programme. Okay, Dan, thank you for giving up more time. The webinar was a real success on Wednesday. Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, it was good. It was really nice, actually. Yeah, and lovely that it was quite well attended. Really nice to see some interest out there.
So over 800 people and there for the entire event as well. So lots of people fully clued up now on lasers and glaucoma.
And
so hopefully optometrists listening to this can put their laser pens down and listen carefully to all of those questions that we didn't have a chance to answer during the webinar. And absolutely, there were lots of them. So if you're listening to this and we haven't answered any particular one of your questions, do feel free to email us afterwards and we'll always pick that up. But we're working through the most popular questions that came up that we were unable to answer during the webinar itself. First question, is it worth doing a peripheral iridotomy on a patient with rubeosis?
Yeah, so a very good question there. So those who watched the webinar might have seen that I was using the acronym PAC quite a lot, primary angle closure. And as I mentioned, I think in the talk, relative pupillary block is one of the main factors, if it were the main factor really, in primary angle closure. But when we get into the realms of rubeosis, we're not talking about primary angle closure anymore. So this is a secondary form of angle closure. So you have obviously vessels growing on the front of the iris, but you also have fibrovascular tissue developing in the angle. And so rather than this being what's usually called a pushing mechanism of angle closure, as you have in primary angle closure, where you have pushing from fluid buildup behind the iris, pushing the iris forwards, this is more of a pulling mechanism where you have this fibrovascular tissue in the angle contracting and basically dragging the iris up into the angle. So essentially, pupillary block is not part of the mechanism and therefore an iridotomy wouldn't be helpful. So very good question.
Next question. Do you think optometrists should only be delivering laser in hospitalised services? What about community clinics, private clinics, GP practices, poly practices for that matter? Did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, a very good question again. I don't know if I mentioned during the talk, but the talk was originally written for a sort of hospital optometrist audience and was tweaked subsequently. So I hadn't spent a huge amount of time, I suppose, thinking about the community opportunities, particularly when the AOP sort of suggested that they didn't think that they could ensure people in community setting, could ensure optometrists in the community setting for doing these treatments. But you know, I've had several conversations with people since, and it's evident that there are other providers of indemnity insurance that might be willing to fill that gap. And I think that opens up all sorts of possibilities. I will say I'm not sure I can see this sort of thing happening in a typical high street optometry practice, but certainly the idea of, you know, community clinics, GP surgeries, anything that's, if these have got, you know, partnerships possibly with nearby trusts, premises that are covered by the CQC, suddenly I think there are opportunities there. And obviously, you know, we're going to be desperately in need of additional capacity in the coming years. So I think that really needs looking into.
So you spoke about clinical governance, professional indemnity insurance, adequate training, and you feel there'll be enough of a volume of patients to support these centres in the community. Do you think it'd be a first stop, actually, and actually hospital departments will actually only be seeing people as a secondary layer?
Yes, it's an interesting one, that, isn't it? Because, I mean, obviously, if somebody has suspected glaucoma, then NICE guidance currently suggests that decision needs to be made by a consultant ophthalmologist or someone kind of immediately under their supervision. In the cases of primary angle closure suspect, our current term our contemporary term for sort of narrow anterior chamber angles, that these people don't actually have glaucoma. They just have an anatomical configuration that might leave them at risk of a certain type of glaucoma. So potentially for people with appropriate qualifications and training, I can't say that I could rule that out completely. Yeah, I think there are some interesting possibilities.
Really interesting. So that's a nice segue onto the next one, which is about patients with a Van Herrick of a quarter. Should they definitely have a PI?
Well, this is an interesting area as well, and quite topical, because currently the guidance would suggest yes, but those with expertise in the field, and I'm thinking particularly of comments I've heard made by Paul Foster, based at Moorfields and University College London, who has a specific research interest in angle closure. Some of his comments in recent times have suggested that he feels maybe the thresholds for when we start doing laser iridotomies might fall. And that's off the back of some research work that I think he was involved in particularly the ZAP trial, aptly named, for laser treatment that was carried out in southern China, which showed that laser iridotomy reduced the risk of primary angle closure by about 50%. But the actual numbers of people in both the treated and untreated groups that were going on to develop primary angle closure were relatively small. And that means that, the epidemiological term that's used for it is usually the number needed to treat. In other words, how many patients with a certain risk factor do you have to treat with a certain intervention, obviously here that we're talking about laser iridotomy, to prevent one case of angle closure. And the number needed to treat figure for the ZAP trial, after following these people for 6 years, was 44. And bearing in mind, these are the reason this study's being done where it is that these are the highest risk racial group for developing angle closure. So we're talking about the highest risk people. And yet after 6 years, they're in a position where they had to treat 44 people to prevent one case of angle closure. And I think listening to him speak, Paul's view on this is also that if you're living in a Western society where you have close proximity to good medical resources, then actually, even if a patient's unlucky and does go into angle closure, the outcomes are pretty good, providing you've got a decent eye clinic relatively nearby. So there might be more of a case for offering iridotomy to people working overseas in the armed forces or in very remote areas. But I suspect that the guidance may change in the coming years, that we might be doing yet less routine prophylactic ones. So it's a very interesting question.
So from a very simplistic perspective, so if the risk is lower in a Caucasian population like in England, that would probably then mean that the numbers needed to treat would be much higher, sort of 80, 90, 100.
That's what we'd anticipate, yeah, exactly.
Next question. Our local eye department informed us they're no longer carrying out PIs on the fellow eye. Does that fit in with that? I guess this is, do you perform these prophylactic ones? If you're doing one, you then do two?
Well, going back to the ZAP trial again and Paul's comments, so that he sort of feels that the people who should be treated are the high risk ones. And you can either define those because of being high risk of having a poor outcome because they're in a very remote setting, or you can define them as being high risk because of the clinical findings. And basically the highest risk of all is somebody who's had primary angle closure in one eye already, because there it's been shown that their 5-year risk of developing acute primary angle closure in the other eye is about 50%. So essentially, I'm surprised to hear that comment, and I suspect there might be a bit of a communication mix-up there, because that's they're top of the list, essentially. Someone who's had primary angle closure in the other eye is very top of the list for a laser iridotomy in the other eye, in my impression.
So another spin on the same question. Would it be warranted to routinely refer an asymptomatic patient who has a narrow angle or Van Herrick of grade 1 for prophylactic treatment in the absence of abnormal IOPs?
Yeah, so again, this is really along the same lines of what we've just talked about. So currently, if they are grade 1, whether they have symptoms or not, we would anticipate those being referred in. It may be the case in the future that referral guidance changes and that maybe community optometrists might be looked upon more to just keep a watch on these people. Obviously, they'll need to have detailed advice about what symptoms might suggest that they're beginning to develop a problem, a primary angle closure attack. But it'd be interesting to see what happens in the next year or two. We may be shifting more in that direction.
Interesting question here about lasers and energy. So where does the energy from the laser go after it's hit the iris? Is bits in the eye going to be warming up?
Yeah, so it does dissipate. I mean, the first thing I would say here is we every now and again get a question from the patient saying, well, you know, if you're thinking a little bit more of a sort of Flash Gordon laser beam, I suspect, if you're firing an iris straight into my eye, then how come it's not burning a hole in my cornea on the way in? So the main issue here is that the laser has a very precise focal plane. So essentially, we didn't talk about this during the talk, but from the operator's point of view, what I see is a constant aiming beam of a little red laser dot created on the patient's iris. And there are actually two dots, maybe more in some instruments, such that you know where you are from a depth point of view. If you're in front of the iris, you'll see two red dots, if you're focused in front of the iris, that is. And then as you move towards the iris, the dots will come together until they're single. Then you're focused on the iris. And if you push further forward, you'll see two dots again because you're focused behind. And what you see as the operator is, if you're not perfectly focused on the iris, then as you fire the instrument, you will typically see virtually no effect whatsoever from your laser energy. So first of all, the energy, because it's dissipated, is kind of much weaker, or it's spread over a larger area, shall we say, is much weaker just in front of and behind the treatment area. But also, obviously, the energy will dissipate further back inside the eye. Thankfully, we've got some vitreous for it to get to before it comes across the retina. But posterior segment complications are certainly possible. I just took a few here off from the Shirari, Hitchings, Crowston, glaucoma textbook, which is on the one of the college e-books covering glaucoma, which mentions among the posterior segment complications, choroidal effusion, decompression retinopathy, retinal and subhyaloid hemorrhages, retinal detachment, central serous chorea retinopathy, etc. But all these are very rare, and certainly, you know, having been doing these treatments for a few years now, I've never seen anything of that nature myself.
Practically, do you recommend patients in your clinic take a paracetamol or ibuprofen before or after the procedure, or is that a bit of an urban myth?
Actually, I mean, it's something that we could think about. It might be worth mentioning in our patient information. We would generally say that if asked about it, that the patient could just take whatever they would normally take, really. Aspirin, etc., wouldn't be a good idea for sort of obvious reasons relating to blood thinning. But to take their usual ibuprofen or something would be absolutely fine.
But most people don't need any analgesics at all.
Yeah, that tends to be the case.
Next question now. How long typically would a PI last for? And also SLT, how long does that typically last for?
Yeah, so quite separate answers for these ones. So laser iridotomy, generally, as I think I mentioned briefly in the talk, if you the size to aim for is about 500 microns, half a millimeter, and if you achieve that, then the evidence is that it's very rare for the laser iridotomy to close later, providing there's no chronic inflammatory processes going in the eye. So your chronic uveitis patients, that's a different kettle of fish. But aside from those, it's unusual for them to close. And the effect is immediate. And this is quite topical for our unit at the moment, actually, because we, at the beginning of the COVID period, we're doing everything we possibly could to avoid people making unnecessary visits to the eye clinic. So we actually took the decision to stop using pilocarpine prior to laser iridotomy. And that maybe sometimes makes the treatment a little bit more challenging and getting an ideal position of the laser iridotomy a little bit more difficult for us as the operator. But the advantage is that you can send your patient off for a 1 hour, as mentioned in the talk, before you check their intraocular pressure. But when they come back, aside from just checking their pressure to make sure they haven't had an intraocular pressure spike, you can look at their iridotomy to check that it's patent, and you can straight away do a gonioscopy. And if the laser iridotomy has worked, then the angle will be wider there and then, because the effect is immediate. The reason we have to stop using the pilocarpine is that obviously pilocarpine, as everyone will know, is potentially a treatment for angle closure. It opens the angle. So if you've used pilocarpine, you can't tell whether your iridotomy has been effective in widening the angle, because you put an eye drop in that will widen it as well. So that's been an interesting development for us. So yeah, so only, you know, I had a laser clinic yesterday and I had two patients where I did laser iridotomies and I discharged them on the day. Whereas prior to that, we were using pilocarpine on the day and then bringing them back 6 or 8 weeks later to do the gonioscopy then.
Do you think that'll be a permanent change?
I don't know. I mean, we happen to have a consultant in our unit who never uses pilocarpine to do iridotomies with anyway, and generally feels that it's nasty stuff. So it probably came from him initially. I generally found it easier than I was expecting. The iris, I was expecting the iris to behave rather differently without the sort of added tension induced by the meiosis, and actually there's been less of a difference than I expected. So that it wouldn't be a problem for me, certainly.
And what about SLT? How long that would last?
Yes. So SLT, so that takes around about a month to take effect, because you're triggering a process whereby you're injuring, mildly injuring the trabecular meshwork, which triggers recruitment of white blood cells, macrophages, which effectively then sort of gobble up some of the extracellular material that's resisting the flow of aqueous through the trabecular meshwork. So in terms of how long it takes to come on, a month, and then in terms of how long they last, well, you tend to think of a period of several years. I don't have the light study figure in front of me, but I think it was something on the lines of 3/4 of their patients were still at target 3 years after their SLT. And obviously then you can repeat it. We tend to treat with up to about 3 or 4 SLTs over time if they've responded to the first one.
So moving away from PIs and SLT, talking about YAG laser now, member has asked, do you think we should also be able to carry out YAG laser do you think we should be able to carry out YAG laser capsulotomies in the community?
That's easy for you to say. Yes, I mean, as it happens, it's not mentioned in the talk, but during my training, I did learn all three types of laser treatment in parallel. And essentially, if you're able to do a laser iridotomy, then carrying out a YAG laser capsulotomy is a relatively simple procedure. So absolutely would be my answer to that.
Okay. Do you need any specific college higher qualifications in order to carry out these procedures?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I mentioned the higher qualifications in my talk, but mainly because, you know, all of this underlines the possibilities for optometrists taking on the higher level care. Obviously, that the higher qualifications, you know, don't include this kind of thing. They're not specific. So I think we'd need to be seeing, and I know there are a number in development already, we'd need to be seeing sort of specific courses that cover this sort of thing, because obviously the higher qualifications, for example, don't cover all the kind of laser safety issues and, you know, how you have to set up a laser room and all that kind of thing. So I think realistic, very very desirable, but a dedicated course, I think, is more likely.
So almost there'd form a kind of a foundation. If you had the college higher or diploma in glaucoma, that would be a great foundation, and then you'd go off and have a secondary learning in a laser course.
And thinking particularly of the SLT treatment, then, you know, if you have the college diploma in glaucoma, then you're going to be very useful with a gonioscopy lens. And that is an absolute necessary starting point for doing SLT, because otherwise you'll be potentially lasering the wrong thing.
When undertaking LPI, is there a significant risk of the crystalline lens, or is there a risk of damage to the crystalline lens?
Yes, there is. It's certainly cataract formation or the acceleration of pre-existing cataract, and even zonular dehiscence when there's a weakness of the supporting zonules of the lens. They're all, again, listed among the recognized sort of complications of laser iridotomy. You know, I haven't come across this in my personal experience, but it may be the case that you probably would have to design a proper study or do a very careful audit to find these things, because they're going to be relatively uncommon and they may not become obvious until some time after the treatment. So certainly it's listed as a potential complication of laser iridotomy in the textbooks. It's something I haven't personally encountered, but there may be a bit of bias in that, as I've hinted.
And presumably, going back to the ZAP study where you said if the numbers needed to treat is 44 patients for every one benefit, those 44 patients are all exposed to these potential risks and complications.
Yeah, that's right. So there's, you know, there are healthcare costs and follow-up costs, and then there's separate issues of worry from the patient's point of view and that kind of thing. But yes, there are other potential complications, exactly.
Interestingly, do you ever refer people for clear lens extraction or cataract removal if there's early signs of that? Does that ever change, become part of your kind of treatment matrix?
Yes, absolutely. So if someone has, let's say, visually significant cataract as well as narrow anterior chamber angles, if it looks as though their cataract needs doing anyway, then obviously that will address the narrow anterior chamber angle as well as addressing the patient's vision. So our unit, certainly, we don't tend to go ahead and carry out a laser iridotomy in advance of the cataract surgery. But we tend to say for these patients that we want them treated within the glaucoma surgical team. So they have a consultant who's used to dealing with shallow anterior chambers and that kind of thing. But otherwise, yeah, we just get straight on with offering the cataract surgery. But if there's no visually significant cataract, then that's difficult to justify. The EAGLE study or EAGLE trial specifically looked at this issue to try and answer the question of should we not bother with laser iridotomy and just go ahead and do a cataract extraction. And essentially that showed us that cataract extraction only wins out if the patient has significantly elevated intraocular pressure. So in our sort of asymptomatic narrow angles but normal pressure patients, unless there's visually significant cataract anyway, then it probably can't be justified.
Next question is, does long-term use of IOP lowering drugs affect the success of an SLT treatment?
Well, essentially, SLT is exactly the same as an eye drop in terms of you tend to get the biggest effect from the first thing. So when you start a patient on an eye drop, let's say a prostaglandin obviously tends to be the nice recommended first line eye drop treatment, you tend to get hopefully an intraocular pressure drop of 25-30%. And then if you add another eye drop on top of that, you won't get as big a percentage drop as if that second eye drop had been used as the first one, if that makes sense. So there's a bit of diminishing returns. As you add in each sequential eye drop, you get less of an improvement in intraocular pressure. And it's the same for SLT, really. SLT works best in terms of percentage drops when it's used as a primary treatment, unless it's not so good when it's used in addition to eye drops that are being taken already.
Next question, do optometrists need the IP qualification in order to carry out laser procedures?
So this would need thinking about potentially for anything being done in the community setting. I mean, certainly as far as in the hospital setting is concerned, I think it's nice if the optometrist carrying out these treatments is able to prescribe. And I suspect that your average optometrist who would be interested in doing this will probably be pursuing that or completed their IP already. I mean, certainly in the hospital environment, there are other ways of this being done. Probably the most obvious one being something known as a patient group direction, a PGD, which is where a document that oversees patients being identified by group rather than individually, and allowing a non-prescriber to be able to, if the patient in front of them matches the description of that group, then they're able to administer or give them the drop. So they can't give them a prescription or anything to take to a pharmacy, but they could give them a sufficient supply to cover their post-iridotomy steroid use, which is only going to be, you know, one bottle will cover them for the usual period that we would want. So there are some options there.
But generally, it just makes sense, doesn't it? People who are interested in it.
Exactly. Yeah, that's how I would feel about it.
Okay. How does SLT work? How does it lower the pressure? And
yeah, so as well, touched on this a little bit earlier. It essentially, there are different theories, sort of mechanical and biological, as to how it happens. But I think it's generally accepted that you're likely injuring the trabecular meshwork tissue. The laser energy is preferentially soaked up by the pigmented cells of the trabecular meshwork. And then that injury triggers a response whereby white blood cells, monocytes, are recruited to that area. They then transform into macrophages, who then sort of gobble up some of the material that you can think of as essentially blocking the trabecular meshwork. So they're basically freeing up the trabecular meshwork and allowing aqueous to drain through it faster via that route.
So final question now. Over the last decade or so, you've led goniostomy workshops for the college at Optometry Tomorrow many years, and always at the end of that session, people leave the room with a big beaming smile on their face because they've seen the angle for the first time and they think it's amazing. Questions come here about, do you watch for the gush? So is this a something that you witness when you're performing laser, which is particularly exciting or necessary to see, or is it a bit of a myth?
No, it's quite nice to see. Certainly, and there's a, I don't know if anyone has picked up on the final slide of the talk, I put up a few links for videos. One of those is off one of the SLT instrument manufacturer treatment sites, and the other one is just from an ophthalmologist who's recorded a PI being done, and that really nicely shows this. So essentially, going back to sort of first principles, if you like, we're in a position where the iris is in a convex shape, bulging forward slightly, if you like, narrowing the angle, and it's doing that because of this pressure differential across the iris. There's a bit more pressure behind the iris than there is in front. So as you might imagine, as you work your way through the iris, making your iridotomy, as you work from front to back, as soon as you manage to puncture the iris pigment epithelium at the back, then you immediately get a gush of fluid. And so that's always quite satisfying because you know that the iris is moving backwards as that gush of fluid happens. The downside of it is that it tends to be quite sort of turbid, mucky looking fluid, which then accumulates in front of your iridotomy. And when you've just had that first gush of fluid, you've got a hole there, but it's probably not large enough yet. You've got a bit more work to do to get it to that ideal 500 micron diameter. So you've got a bit more work to do. And often this sort of mucky fluid that's come through in this gush from behind the iris, you can tell that it's soaking up some of the laser energy. So if you get a big gush like that, although it's very good, and I often actually mention it to the patient that I've seen that, and that tends to suggest that the treatment has worked, and we'll check that later. But it's often not a bad idea to just stop on that eye and swap over to the other one for a bit, start your treatment on the other eye, and then come back to that eye, by which time that gubbins has dissipated, and it's easier and requires less energy to enlarge the iridotomy. So yeah, good question.
Dan, thank you so much for your time. Really interesting answers, really comprehensive, and I've certainly enjoyed this session just as much as the webinar itself. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for listening to another webinar extra.
For more college podcasts, head to the college website or just keep refreshing this feed every 5 seconds until another one appears.
And please do also like, rate, and subscribe, and we'll speak to you again soon.